and welcome to Religion in the News. This is Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next 30 minutes we'll be featuring articles from The Atlantic, from The Washington Post, from The Associated Press, and more. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. And podcast editions of this and other episodes of Religion in the News may be found on our website at ncreadingservice.org. We begin this week on Religion in the News with an article from The Atlantic published June 7th, and the title of this article is The Scandal Rocking the Evangelical World. Subheadline, The Sudden Departure of Russell Moore is Forcing an Overdue Conversation About the Crises of American Christendom. And this is by Peter Wenner, who is listed as a contributing writer at The Atlantic and a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. "This is an earthquake," a prominent Christian writer told me. The publication of an extraordinary February 24, 2020 letter by Russell Moore, one of the most influential and respected evangelicals in America, and a friend, has shaken the Christian world. When the letter was written, Moore was the president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, the policy arm of the Southern Baptist Convention, the largest Protestant denomination in the United States. The letter, sent to the ERLC's Board of Trustees, offers a devastating indictment of the denomination's executive committee. Moore's letter was leaked to Religion News Service a few weeks after he resigned from the ERLC. And on June 1st, Emmanuel Nashville, a church not affiliated with the Southern Baptist Convention, announced that Moore would become its pastor in residence, which means that one of the most important figures in the SBC has completely broken with the denomination he has been a part of for virtually his entire life. Moore's 4,000-word letter explains why. His departure was not primarily prompted, as many people had assumed, by his role as an outspoken critic of Donald Trump, although that had clearly upset powerful members within the politically and theologically conservative denomination. Instead, the letter suggests, the breach was caused by the stands he had taken against sexual abuse within the SBC and on racial reconciliation, which had infuriated the executive committee. The chair of the executive committee at the time, Mike Stone, is now running for SBC president. According to RNS, supporters have touted Moore's resignation as proof of Stone's effectiveness as a leader. Stone released a statement in response to Moore's letter, alleging that it contained numerous misrepresentations and calling it an attempt to influence the coming denominational election. "The presenting issue here is that first and foremost of sexual abuse," Moore wrote. "This executive committee, through their bylaws work group, exonerated churches in a spur-of-the-moment meeting from serious charges of sexual abuse cover-up." At the ERLC's national conference in 2019, Moore interviewed Rachel Den Hollander, a former gymnast who was the first woman to publicly accuse Larry Nassar, the USA Gymnastics doctor, of sexual assault. Nassar was the perpetrator in the largest sexual abuse scandal in sports history and will serve the rest of his life in prison. In the interview, Den Hollander criticized the executive committee for how it had handled the case of Jennifer Lyell, who had accused a Southern Baptist seminary professor of abuse. "The story Rachel told is accurate," Moore wrote, "and my wife and I know that because we were, even during that very meeting, ministering alongside others to that mistreated young woman." Moore, in a letter written to the outgoing president of the SBC just more than a week ago, said Lyell attempted to tell her story of abuse through the channels of the executive committee, and her own words were altered by executive committee staff to make it seem as though this horrifying experience had been a consensual affair. Lyell, a former vice president at the SBC's publishing arm, Lifeway Christian Resources, told the Washington Post that she had lost her job, her reputation, and her health because of her mistreatment by the SBC's executive committee, and she confirmed Moore's account of its bullying and intimidation. The Post also reported that three employees who work in SBC institutions and one former employee corroborated several of the factual details of Moore's letter. And Lyell's account was corroborated by Den Hollander. "It shows the level of corruption and vile behavior that comes from the leaders of the SBC, the ones who really have the power," she told the Post. That Moore had allowed Den Hollander to tell Lyell's story on stage enraged some executive committee trustee leadership, he wrote in his letter to the ERLC's Board of Trustees. "The executive committee was particularly aggrieved," he continued, "because it had contributed funds for the Caring Well Conference, co-sponsored by the ERLC, which was intended to address sexual abuse in the church. I came away from these conversations with the distinct feeling that I was being told, "You've got a nice little commission there. It would be a shame if something happened to it," Moore went on. I told Maria that at the time. It was and is chilling, especially seeing what they had in mind to do under cover of darkness. The letter's next passage was written in bold italics. "I am trying to say this as clearly as I can to you, brothers and sisters. These are the tactics that have been used to create a culture where countless children have been torn to shreds, where women have been raped and then broken down." But confronting sexual abuse wasn't the only issue dividing Moore from the SBC Executive Committee. "The other absolutely draining and unrelenting issue has been that of racial reconciliation," Moore wrote. "My family and I have faced constant threats from white nationalists and white supremacists, including within our convention. Some of them have been involved in neo-Confederate activities going back for years. Some are involved with groups funded by white nationalist and nativist organizations. Some of them have just expressed raw racist sentiment behind closed doors." Moore cited specific examples. One SBC leader who was at the forefront of these behind-closed-doors assaults had already ripped me to shreds verbally for saying in 2011 that the Southern Baptist Convention should elect an African-American president, he wrote. The same leader told a gathering that the conservative resurgence is like the Civil War, except this time, unlike the last one, the right side won. "I walked out of that gathering, as did one of you." Moore also mentioned an SBC leader who, during a discussion about black victims of police violence, had asserted that only those with guns would prevent black people from burning down all of our cities. On top of all that, Moore alleged that vicious guerrilla tactics had been used against him, including task force investigations, whose purpose was to keep a cloud over me and to keep me self-censoring and silent about these matters. "We know we can't take you down," Moore said an SBC figure told him in 2017. "All our wives and kids are with you. This is psychological warfare, to make you think twice before you do or say something." Within a day of the publication of Moore's letter, I heard from people who told me that this whole episode didn't surprise them. One pastor who requested anonymity in order to speak openly put it to me this way. "Having grown up in the South, I think Southern Baptist culture is probably uniquely this way, but working in a church that isn't in the South, this stuff still rears its head. Not as much the same presenting issues, but you still fundamentally get people who are in love with power and will take any means necessary to beat you down so they have power and you are subservient to them, not the gospel." Countless people of the Christian faith lead lives of integrity. I have been on the receiving end of profound expressions of grace and generosity from people who have walked alongside me during difficult times. I have seen people who, in the words of the Apostle Paul, shine like stars in the universe. Throughout history, Christianity has made great contributions to art and literature, to acts of charity, and defending human rights. The abolitionist and civil rights movements can't be understood without taking into account the role of faith. The same is true of the anti-abortion movement. I was recently reminded of a story about Evelyn Waugh, who had behaved particularly rudely to a young French intellectual at a dinner party. Waugh was asked by the host, Nancy Mitford, how he could act so meanly and yet consider himself a believing and practicing Catholic. "You have no idea," Wall is said to have responded, "how much nastier I would be if I was not a Catholic." Nonetheless, something has gone awry. The revelations contained in Russell Moore's letter were only the latest links in a disturbingly long chain of offenses. In 2019, the Houston Chronicle published a 6-part series on abuse within SBC churches. One of America's most prominent female evangelicals, Beth Moore, no relation to Russell, split with the SBC earlier this year, citing the staggering disorientation of seeing denominational leaders support Trump. She has also denounced the demonic stronghold of white supremacy and the sexism and misogyny that is rampant in segments of the SBC. "There comes a time when you have to say, 'This is not who I am,'" Beth Moore explained to RNS. "I'm still a Baptist, but I can no longer identify with Southern Baptists." Yet the problems are hardly confined to the SBC. The Catholic Church has been rocked by horrifying sexual abuse scandals. Earlier this year, an investigation found credible evidence that Ravi Zacharias, the revered evangelist who died last year, had been engaged in sexual misconduct spanning many years in several continents. The Ravi Zacharias International Ministries Board apologized for its role in discrediting one of the women Zacharias exploited and later slandered. And Jerry Falwell Jr. was forced to resign as the president and chancellor of Liberty University, one of the largest evangelical universities in the world, after allegations of sexual misconduct. But the issues go beyond matters of sexual misconduct and abuse. Christians appear more susceptible than non-Christians to embracing conspiracy theories. 31% of white evangelical Christian Republicans believe in the accuracy of the claim that Donald Trump has been secretly fighting a group of child sex traffickers that include prominent Democrats and Hollywood elites. Partisan, cultural, and religious regional identities tend to shape religious identities. In American pop culture parlance, evangelical now basically means whites who consider themselves religious and who vote Republican, according to the Baylor University historian Thomas Kidd. In so many instances, cultural identity is completely dominant over faith. It is the prism through which faith is interpreted. Evangelical used to denote people who claimed the high moral ground. Now in popular usage, the word is nearly synonymous with hypocrite. Timothy Keller, one of the most influential evangelicals in the world, wrote in The New Yorker in 2017. I have heard from pastors in different parts of America who describe a generational catastrophe that is unfolding because of how disillusioned young people, including many young Christians, are by what they have seen. One of the more incisive comments about the gap we often see between faith and works sticks with me today, that for too many people of the Christian faith, Jesus is a hood ornament. The man who told me that was Russell Moore. But a blistering phrase used by Jesus echoes most in my mind. He likened hypocritical religious leaders who abandon their calling and lead others astray to whitewashed tombs, which look beautiful on the outside, but inside are full of the bones of the dead and everything unclean. In their eagerness to defend their faith, many Christians refuse to look honestly at the crises American Christendom faces and the corruption within its ranks. They prefer to present to the world a spiritual Potemkin village, projecting an image of righteousness that hides some disturbing realities. There's a desire to conceal the abuses and the wounds, the struggles and the failures, the harsh judgmentalism and craving to dominate and dehumanize others, the doubts and the dark sides. The viciousness of church politics can rival pretty much any other politics you can name. The difference is that the viciousness within churches is often cloaked in lofty spiritual language and euphemisms. Some people act in deeply cynical ways. Others simply choose to look away, in part to keep at bay the cognitive dissonance, the emotional discomfort and disorientation that might be sparked by admitting, even if only to themselves, that many people who claim that Jesus is integral to their life are actually running on empty. This is hardly the whole of the Christian story and the Christian pilgrimage. The failures of some institutions need to be seen alongside the remarkable contributions by groups such as the International Justice Mission, a global organization that protects people from violence. And the rot that has been so powerfully and so painfully exposed by Russell Moore is not an indictment of Jesus any more than the failures of the religious authorities in first century Palestine were. A theologian recently reminded me that the church is not the hope of the world. Its purpose is to be a witness to the hope of the world, even if that witness is often imperfect. But those of us of the Christian faith do seem to be overdoing the imperfect part. The chasm that currently exists between how Christians like to think of themselves and how they are actually seen, between the invocations of grace and the acts of ungrace, between condemning impurity in others while engaging in it themselves, has to be fully acknowledged and dramatically narrowed. Christians would do themselves a favor if they spent a little less time obsessing over the secular left, a little less time feeling that they are victims and a persecuted minority, and a little more time in honest self-examination. As a well-known preacher from many years ago asked, "Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye?" He asked the question because he recognized the tendencies against which we all have to fight. A few days ago, I wrote to a friend of mine who's a pastor and asked him, if so many people who say they've committed their life to Christ live a life that is in many areas so antithetical to the ways of Christ, what are we to make of that? He offered some thoughtful insights on Jesus' parable about the wheat and the tares and the reality of human sin from which Christians are hardly immune. But because he's honest and not interested in spin, he admitted, "I do find the lack of sanctification in so many folks frustrating, as do you. And yes, I do get sick of making explanations for what shouldn't be." The poet Christian Wyman, who returned to his faith after having wandered from it, wrote in My Bright Abyss, Meditation of a Modern Believer, that Christ is always being remade in the image of man, which means that his reality is always being deformed to fit human needs or what humans perceive to be their needs. The challenge that followers of Jesus face is to push aside as best we can the deformations, including those we generate ourselves, in order to move a few steps closer to the reality of Jesus. Because for all of our failures or of his followers, and despite all the things we might get wrong, we keep coming back. Our hearts were won over not by Jesus' moral demands, but by his grace, not by his miracles as much as by his wounds, not because he needs us, but because we need him. Our next article comes from the Washington Post, and this was published in the Post on June 6th. And the headline on this story is, "Vaccinations Push the Question, Are You Going Back to Church?" And the article was written by Michelle Borstein of the Washington Post. Now that more people are vaccinated, many are re-examining their routines, pondering whether they want and are ready to go back to their favorite pre-pandemic coffee shop, exercise class, or concert hall. Amid this investigation of needs is a weighty one. What about worship services? Faith leaders have been anxious about this moment since the pandemic broke out a year ago, and the possibility that Americans, in their secularizing, convenience-oriented country, would spend a year away from houses of worship and decide it suited them just fine. All year, clergy have been waiting to see if slews of people will decide to become virtual-only members, flip between multiple virtual services, or just quit congregational life altogether. The call to return has concrete heft in the Catholic Church, whose canon law says Sunday Mass must be observed in the universal church as the primordial holy day of obligation. When the pandemic began last year, bishops offered a dispensation, a divine pass from coming in person. In recent weeks, however, some bishops across the country have been withdrawing the dispensations, including on Wednesday in Washington, Baltimore, West Virginia, Richmond, Northern Virginia, and Wilmington, Delaware. Thanking God for the progress the country has made in curbing the pandemic, the bishop's statement said, "Many places in our region are enjoying a return to some sense of normalcy." Therefore, they wrote, the obligation will be reinstated as of the weekend of June 26th and 27th. "We welcome and encourage the faithful to return to full in-person participation of the Sunday Eucharist, the source and summit of our Catholic faith." Yet in 2021, simply welcoming people back isn't simple. Catholics, like Americans in general, are divided about the continuing danger of the pandemic and how well vaccines will protect them indoors. Congregations in some cases have been places of division during this intense year of disease and protest. This is happening as the number of Catholics who said they belong to a parish is shrinking. That figure dropped from 76% in 2000 to 58% in 2020, according to a Gallup poll released in April, a faster rate than for Protestant denominations. The year also accelerated the move into a virtual world, which for the spiritual leads to questions about where exactly is the divine present, or absent for that matter. Some find the return of the obligation motivating and encouraging, and long to be together in person. Other Catholics say the language is a turnoff, judgmental and not in tune with powerful online communities that have been created this past year. "We need to be together in person receiving the sacraments. The one thing about the Catholic Church is it's deeply physical. It's not some cloud religion. We eat our God," said Michael Murphy, director of the Hank Center for the Catholic Intellectual Heritage at Loyola University Chicago. "Coming in person is part of the spiritual diet. Get here, come on back." The Catholic Church, he said, was more legalistic in previous centuries, but for decades has emphasized a more integrated view of maturity and pragmatism that he said empowered lay people more to make decisions about what's good for them based on their own conscience, including about the obligation to attend weekly Mass. A lot of modern Catholics, he said, don't realize that obligation is still in place. While Murphy has been going to Mass with his family since last summer and said he feels overjoyed to receive communion in person, he knows people who are diehard Mass attendees who still haven't returned out of fear of the virus. He thinks bishops in their announcements should have made explicit statements encouraging people to weigh their mental health. Different bishops have used different language in describing dispensations. The D.C. area bishop said the obligation doesn't apply to the sick or those who are confined in their homes or a medical facility or those with serious underlying health conditions. One should consult his or her local pastor if questions arise about the obligation to attend Mass. The Archdiocese of Portland, Oregon, in mid-May said the dispensation hadn't been lifted, but all who are able are encouraged to attend Mass. Those who are vulnerable or concerned about the risks of the pandemic are not obligated to attend. The Bishop of Tyler, Texas, lifted the dispensation in March, aware of the centrality of the Mass to our lives as Catholics and the obligation attached to it. However, Bishop Joseph Strickland wrote, that doesn't apply to people who are sick, high risk, caring for others who are homebound or pregnant, or if you have a significant fear or anxiety of becoming ill by being at Mass. Faith leaders are between a rock and a hard place, said the Reverend William Gurney, pastor of St. Joseph's on Capitol Hill. We naturally want people back to Mass because it will help their spiritual lives. We worry about people who are genuinely afraid of the virus and think the church isn't taking their concerns seriously, he wrote in an email. But we are ready to welcome people back to regularly attending Mass. Most pastors think that if the situation persists, it looks like we think the Sunday obligation is optional. We have to obey God's commandment for our own good. Jennifer Janis, who works in development for a Catholic school outside Richmond, has been going to church in person on Sundays with her husband and three children since the fall, whenever she could reserve a spot online. Her mother is elderly and devout, but won't return in person until she feels completely safe, in part based on the infection rate in the county where she lives, not based on the dispensation being lifted. You can completely feel the difference between watching it on TV compared with being there in person, she said. Part of being the body of Christ, she added, is being together. Barbara Carroll, who used to live and attend church in Rockville, Maryland, but now lives in North Carolina, said she's been a lifelong regular Mass attendee, but has shifted during the past year after participating in Masses from all over the world that she finds inspiring and challenging. Committing to one now seems limiting, she says, and bishops trying to frame her decision in negative terms is another example of the church ignoring culture and the benefits of technology. Attending a big Mass in person, she said, in hindsight feels less like a community event than the creation of a faith community that participates in community service together, mostly without priestly participation, she wrote in an email. Jeannie Kirkhope, who runs a Catholic advocacy group focused on issues in Appalachia, including the environment and poverty, said the lifting of the dispensation is frustrating in West Virginia, a state with less than 35% of people fully vaccinated. It seems we're being told to reaffirm the importance of the collection basket instead, which doesn't bode well for many Catholics here, Kirkhope wrote in an email. The concerned folks here are making their decision with a fully informed conscience rather than out of any sense of obligation. Monsignor Edward Filardi joined his parish in Damascus, Maryland, just south of Frederick, last summer, so he is just now meeting some congregants in person and seeing others maskless for the first time. On the topic of the virus and in-person worship, congregants are all over the map, he said. Filardi questions how many Catholics even know Sunday Mass is obligatory. Some parents have told him the obligation's return helps them get children who cite their dispensation in their pajamas back to church. His view of the live stream was that it was only there during the shutdown, and he plans to end it by the end of the month. The year has been a fascinating experiment in progress and also human nature, what it needs, what fulfills it. This year has been a guessing game. I think sociologists will study it for years to come, he said. We'll continue on religion in the news this week with an article from the Associated Press. This is headlined, JBS settles Muslim discrimination lawsuit for $5.5 million. And this article was written by Thomas Peipert of the AP Dateline Denver. The second largest producer of beef, pork, and chicken in the U.S. will pay up to $5.5 million to settle a lawsuit that claimed the company discriminated against Muslim employees at a meat processing plant in northern Colorado. The U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission filed the lawsuit in federal court in Denver in 2010, saying JBS Swift & Company discriminated against employees at its beef processing plant in Greeley by denying them bathroom breaks and disciplining them more harshly than other workers because they were Muslim, immigrants from Somalia, and black. JBS USA LLC, doing business as JBS Swift & Company, must pay the $5.5 million to about 300 employees who were included in the settlement, which was announced by the commission on Wednesday. Nikki Richardson, a spokeswoman for JBS USA, said the company does not admit any liability in the settlement, prohibits all discrimination and harassment at its facilities, and is committed to diversity and inclusion in the workplace. According to the lawsuit, JBS prevented Muslim employees from praying and harassed them when they tried to pray during scheduled breaks and bathroom breaks. JBS also was accused of shutting off water fountains during the holy month of Ramadan in 2008, keeping Muslim Somali workers from getting a drink at sundown after a day of fasting, and from washing before prayers. According to the lawsuit, JBS managers and other employees threw meat or bones at black and Somali employees, called them offensive names, and tolerated offensive graffiti in restrooms at the Greeley plant, including the use of the N-word, Somalis are disgusting, F-Somalians, and F-Muslims. This case serves as a reminder that systemic discrimination and harassment remain significant problems that we as a society must tackle, EEOC Chair Charlotte Burroughs said in a statement. JBS must take several steps to prevent further discrimination, including allowing former employees covered under the settlement to be eligible for rehire, reviewing, updating, and posting its anti-discrimination policies, and maintaining a 24-hour hotline for reporting discrimination. The company also will be required to provide quiet locations other than bathrooms for employees to pray. Many Somalis started working at the Greeley plant following a 2006 U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement raid in which 270 Hispanic employees were detained. The treatment of the Somali workers came to a head 2 years later when they asked company officials to move the plant's scheduled meal break so they could stop fasting at sunset during Ramadan. Officials agreed to an earlier meal break but changed course 3 days later, and according to the lawsuit, Muslim workers who were told to go outside to pray weren't allowed back into the plant. Days later, several workers were fired for what the company said was an unauthorized work stoppage, according to the lawsuit. We'll wrap up this week on Religion in the News with an article from Religion News Service, New E-Prayer Rug Offers Digital Support to Muslim Prayer. We may have to edit this a bit for time. A new smart prayer rug is being offered as an educational tool for use by Muslims concerned they may make errors in their daily prayers. The company behind the new rug says it has exceeded its funding goal by more than 200%. Fakah Technologies, based in the Persian Gulf Kingdom of Qatar, said the company has raised some $36,000 to develop the product, according to a press release on May 26th. The e-rug is known as Sajda, taking its name from the Arabic term for the act of prostration to God in the direction of the Kaaba in the holy city of Mecca, which Muslims normally perform during prayers. To help guide new and young Muslims, the rug uses voice prompts and an LED display that shows the correct postures of prayer. The developers of Sajda also believe the rug's displays and audio prompts can help those with certain medical conditions, such as Alzheimer's disease or dementia, to better remember the form and words of prayer. For other Muslims, the rug can help the user memorize new verses of the Quran. The rug is also designed to be used for the extended Taraweeh prayers during the month of Ramadan. According to the company website, Sajda acts as your personal trainer, guiding you through the 5 daily mandatory prayers as well as 20 others. The interface and settings of the smart prayer rug are linked to the user's phone or an Apple Watch via Wi-Fi or Bluetooth connectivity. Currently, only Arabic language is supported, but the developers hope to offer other languages in the future. They hope to begin shipping the first units of the electronic prayer rug by December of this year. We've run out of time for this week on Religion in the News. We thank you very much for tuning in. Hope you've enjoyed the program. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and the content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Don't forget that podcast editions of Religion in the News are available at our website. Just visit ncreadingservice.org. This has been Religion in the News from the North Carolina Reading Service. We'll talk to you next time.